KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
So I'm standing on Sunset Boulevard right here just watching an apartment building on fire.
The Pacific Palisades fire has become the most destructive fire in the history of Los Angeles.
We'll have the latest this Wednesday, January 8th on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Violence between Palestinians breaks out in the occupied West Bank as Palestinian Authority security forces crack down on militants.
The fighter is our defense against the Israeli army, because our government cannot protect us.
Also, a new study finds that the key to a healthy gut is eating lots of different kinds of plants, even if you do eat meat as well.
Eating an array of plant-based foods is more important than strictly adhering to a vegan or vegetarian diet pattern.
We'll have those stories and more after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Fast-moving fires in Southern California have now claimed at least 5 lives, burned more than 1,000 homes and businesses, and forced more than 100,000 people to evacuate. As Elise Hugh reports from Los Angeles, high winds mean firefighters are struggling to contain the blaze that have already burned some 16,000 acres.
The Santa Ana winds have fueled 5 major wildfires burning in Los Angeles County. Mandatory evacuation zones have now expanded into densely populated communities like Santa Monica. Los Angeles County has set up evacuation shelters. School districts have canceled classes because of fire risk and dangerous air quality levels from the smoke. Cheryl Houghton is one of the tens of thousands of fire evacuees in the Los Angeles area.
Houses are still being burned. Beloved businesses and landmarks have gone up in flames.
The Eaton Fire, which first ripped through communities of Pasadena and Altadena, is now the most destructive wildfire in L.A. city history. For NPR News, I'm Elise Hugh in Los Angeles.
The Justice Department has filed a voting rights lawsuit against a northeastern Pennsylvania city. As NPR's Hanzi Luong reports, the federal lawsuit argues the way the city of Hazleton holds some of its local elections discriminates against Hispanic voters.
City council members in Hazleton, Pennsylvania are elected as at-large representatives of one voting district. The Justice Department claims that violates Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act by not giving the city's Hispanic voters an equal opportunity to elect candidates of their choice. The DOJ is asking a federal court to order the city to use a different voting system, such as having multiple districts, each represented by one council member. This legal challenge comes less than 2 weeks before the Biden administration hands off control of the Justice Department to the incoming administration of President-elect Donald Trump. Many voting rights advocates are concerned Trump officials will deprioritize cases like this one and scale back enforcing the Voting Rights Act's protections against racial discrimination in elections. Hanzi Luong, NPR News.
Threat of another dock workers' strike on the eastern Gulf Coast is over for now. Dock workers' union and the ocean carriers and port operators have come to a tentative agreement on a new contract. Here's NPR's Andrea Hsu.
The International Longshoremen's Association, representing tens of thousands of dock workers, had threatened to strike again next week if they couldn't reach a deal. A 3-day strike last fall ended when the two sides agreed to raises for dock workers totaling 62% over 6 years. The outstanding issue was automation. Earlier, the union had demanded a complete ban on automation. On that front, the terms have not been released, but the two sides said the agreement protects current jobs and establishes a framework for bringing in technology that will make the port safer and more efficient and capable of handling more cargo. In coming days, dock workers will vote on whether to ratify the agreement. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
A mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow was up 106 points. The Nasdaq fell 10 points. This is NPR. President-elect Donald Trump is now asking the Supreme Court to intervene ahead of his scheduled sentencing Friday on 34 felony counts in connection with his New York hush money case. While that sentencing is not expected to include any jail time, Trump's lawyers are seeking an immediate stay. The Supreme Court is asking for a response from New York prosecutors by tomorrow. The Manhattan DA's office has said it will respond. Trump was convicted of falsifying business records to hide payments to an adult film star to cover up a previous sexual relationship. Grizzly bears are still threatened with extinction and require protection under the Endangered Species Act, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service announced today. Bureau's Jonathan Lambert explains the decision comes after Western states sued the federal government to delist the species.
Grizzly bears were listed under the Endangered Species Act in 1975, when there were fewer than 800 bears in the lower 48 states. Their numbers have improved substantially since then to more than 2,000 bears. That recovery prompted Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming to petition the government to remove federal protections, which would have allowed states to approve hunting. While keeping them listed, the government did propose relaxing restrictions on when grizzly bears can be killed, as the bears are increasingly interacting with private landowners and ranchers. The first Trump administration unsuccessfully attempted to delist the species in 2017 and could try again after taking power later this month. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Crude oil futures prices lost ground as rising inventories put pressure on prices. Oil down 93 cents a barrel to $73.32 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Pew Charitable Trusts, sharing about the state of housing in America on the After the Fact podcast, available at pewtrusts.org/afterthefact, and the Doris Duke Foundation.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California. Strong, persistent winds continue to fuel the multiple wildfires in Los Angeles County that are now responsible for at least 5 deaths. More than 1,000 structures have been destroyed, and firefighters are worried about running out of water and running out of firefighting personnel. NPR's Kirk Sigler joins us now from Los Angeles. Hi, Kirk.
Hi, Ilse.
Hi. So I know that you were able to get into the Pacific Palisades area to see all the destruction caused by the biggest fire burning in the LA Basin right now. And look, I understand it's still very much an active situation, but can you just tell us what you were able to see there?
Well, first of all, from where I'm standing here on Pacific Coast Highway, I was just in the thick of it in the fire, but it's just an extraordinary sight also to see a plume, dark plume, and a mostly deserted PCH right in front of me, except for the occasional emergency vehicle. Then behind me, I'm looking at the plume from the other fire, the other major fire, the Eaton Fire out in Pasadena on the east side of L.A. So the wind is blowing and howling, and then for a minute it'll kind of let up and you think you're okay, but then not. And unfortunately, to your question specifically, what you see around here in Pacific Palisades is the kind of just utter destruction that's getting all too familiar, I think, with these modern urban wildfires. I mean, I was just up there. I saw down twisted power lines, businesses and homes destroyed. The power's out everywhere. There's no cell service. So I actually was able to record myself standing on a debris-strewn Sunset Boulevard, if we can listen to that now.
I'm talking through my N95 mask, and you can hear the crackling of flames. I'm standing on Sunset Boulevard right here just watching an apartment building on fire. It's about 4 stories high, it looks like, or it was. 4th or 5th floor there, there's just one little unit left. Everything else has collapsed. The situation is grim here and actually far worse just up the street. But it's not really that safe to be here for much longer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and also, you know, the wind was howling so much at one point there was a piece of burning tin that blew onto the street from where I was standing, and up in the village of Pacific Palisades, kind of the community center, was pooled water everywhere. A huge oak tree fell over in the middle of the street. It's totally impassable. There's burned businesses and cars everywhere.
It's just horrifying. Well, now authorities are saying that they're concerned about a lack of water, am I right? Like, fire hydrants actually ran dry in the Palisades. What do we know about that?
Well, that's right. That's the terrifying thing. I mean, it's, I think, also leading to a lot of precautionary evacuations elsewhere in Los Angeles. You know, we're in a serious drought here. Los Angeles Department of Water and Power says their system is stressed. There's a lot of ash in it, so boil orders are going to be in effect in some areas. And like you say, just the horror last night, to the worst-case scenario here in Pacific Palisades, when the hydrants went dry. Today I was at an evacuation center over in West L.A., and I met David Keyes. He told me he stayed behind through the night with a neighbor to douse hot spots in his neighborhood, but then at about 3 a.m., and this is confirmed by the authorities, the water just was shut off, and he decided that's when he had to leave. It just wasn't safe. Let's listen to him now.
We were fighting embers for about 3 or 4 hours nonstop before LAFD showed up and took over, but then early a.m., the water pressure disappeared completely.
So also, you know, a very stressful, sleepless night for, you know, tens of thousands of people, really. The Keys, you know, he had grabbed just a few things, and when I met him, he had his friend's little dog with him. He couldn't find a leash, and he was, you know, pretty stressed.
Yeah. Well, before we let you go, Kirk, you know, everyone around here just wants to know about these winds. As you say, they start, then they stop, then they start, then they stop again. What can we expect, do you know?
Well, the high wind advisory is in the forecast through at least some of this evening, as are the red flag warnings. I actually had to just shut my rental car door here to be able to talk to you, because when we've been talking, the wind kicked back up again.
Yeah.
Authorities are saying this isn't just a red flag warning. It's like something even more extreme than that. And it is really, really causing a lot of problems still.
That is NPR's Kirk Sigler. Thank you so much, Kirk, and stay safe, please.
Thank you, Elsa.
As those massive wildfires burn through Southern California, you'll likely hear a lot about the effect of what's called the Santa Ana winds. Many people, especially on the West Coast, are probably familiar with them.
Well, I know I definitely am. But you out there may be asking, what are Santa Ana winds exactly? Well, in this case, high pressure builds over the Nevada and Utah deserts and blows west into the San Gabriel Mountains in coastal California. And then
the key characteristic of those winds are it's downslope. It blows from the top of the mountain, coming down, and experience increasing pressure, or what we call compression, right? And that is causing the air to warm up very quickly.
That's Mingfang Ting, a professor at Columbia University's Climate School.
The rate of warming is about 10 degrees per kilometer of dropping the air altitude. So if the, you know, imagine if the mountain is 2 kilometers high, when it blows from the top of the mountain to the bottom, it'll increase temperature by 20 degrees Celsius, which is like, you know, 30 some degrees Fahrenheit. Very fast, a very effective way of warming up the air.
Then that compressed hot wind blows down to the valley below, pushing between the mountain ranges the way wind picks up in city blocks with tall buildings. Here's Mike Wofford from the National Weather Service.
If it wasn't for the mountain range there, this would never happen. All the winds would just keep going straight across, and those winds descend down. And when they descend down, they accelerate. So they're actually even stronger as they reach the surface than they were higher up.
The Santa Ana winds are a pretty routine part of life here in Southern California in the colder months. But Wofford says this year the winds have been especially bad.
This was not a typical Santa Ana wind event. It was a Santa Ana wind event, but kind of on steroids.
He says it's also unique that these winds have covered so much ground.
In typical Santa Ana events, like I said, it's a little more spotty. It's a much more confined area. But when we get this kind of event, it's much more widespread, and it covers places like Pasadena, which typically, in a normal Santa Ana, wouldn't get any wind, like literally zero wind. Even in other areas, it's quite a bit stronger and more widespread. So it's you know, more destructive, more impactful in many areas than a typical Santa Ana is.
Wofford says the strongest of this Santa Ana wind event is now behind us, thankfully. But that doesn't mean it's over.
It's going to be a battle, and if we didn't already have existing fires, it wouldn't necessarily be a big deal. But because we do, that's going to be an issue that's going to be ongoing for the next week.
The Santa Anas generally blow through Southern California into the spring, though. So if dry conditions persist, so too does the danger of wildfire. A beloved entertainer died this week. James Lee Williams was best known as The Vivian, a drag queen who competed on the TV show Dancing on Ice, starred in musical theater in London, and won the first season of RuPaul's Drag Race UK. The performer was 32 years old. No cause of death has been reported. NPR's Elizabeth Blair has this appreciation.
The Vivian was glamorous, classy, and a statuesque 6'1". On RuPaul's Drag Race UK, she explained where she got the name The Vivian.
The Vivian, I came up with that because I love Vivian Westwood. I wanted a really short and snappy name without one of them tacky surnames, so I came up with The Vivian.
The Vivian did it all. Impressions, including of then-President Donald Trump.
I know the cameras can't see, but you want to see the crowds watching this. There's 3 million people here watching me today.
She could sing, like Cher. As a makeup and costume designer, the Vivian had range. She could glitter it up or dress it down. Once on Drag Race, she was Queen Elizabeth, about to take a walk in the damp countryside. She explained the look.
Of course she's wearing wellies, granny tights, a little plaid skirt, poncho, headscarf. I am just living for this look.
The Vivian was so much more than drag, says Michelle Visage, a judge on RuPaul's Drag Race.
She was an incredible ball of light and talent, and she was a rock for so many of these queens that they would call on her. She was just an incredible person.
The Vivian was born James Lee Williams in North Wales in 1992. He moved to Liverpool when he was 16 to become a makeup artist, and that's where he first saw drag queens.
I've known Vivian for a very long time, back in Liverpool when we both used to sneak out to clubs when we were, let's just say, not supposed to be there.
Fellow drag performer Danny Beard says the Vivian always championed their work.
She's always been a true friend, and she always will be a true friend. It's really hard for me to talk in past tense.
The Vivian was supportive of her fellow drag queens in a number of ways. In an episode of Drag Race, she was open about her drug addiction.
A lot of my drug use was pure boredom. I mean, I worked 7 nights a week. In the day, I didn't do anything, and it was just a habit that caught on a bit too quick and a bit too hard.
The Vivian said she got help from a drug rehab program in Liverpool and spent time in Spain, where she got support from the man who became her husband.
This is why I want to say to people, I fell into that trap, but you can get out of it with the support of and help of friends, family, or even yourself. You've got it deep inside of you, you can stop it, you can do it. Look at me now, I'm on Drag Race Season 1.
After winning Drag Race Season 1, she went on to perform musical theater in London as the Wicked Witch in The Wizard of Oz and the Child Catcher in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. RuPaul wrote on social media, "With a broken heart, I join the entire Drag Race universe in mourning the loss of the Vivian, an incredibly talented queen and a lovely human being." Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Subaru, featuring the 2025 Forester with an updated exterior design and an 11.6-inch Starlink multimedia interface. Learn more at Subaru.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. As negotiators try to bring about a ceasefire in Gaza, there's more fighting in another Palestinian territory, the Israeli-occupied West Bank. This fighting is not just between Israelis and Palestinians, it's between different Palestinian groups. NPR's Emily Fang reports, and a warning, this story contains the sound of gunshots.
NPR producer Nuha Muslay and I drive on a dusty road towards the Jenin refugee camp.
That's the camp. You see it right in front of you.
The camp is a warren of multi-story buildings and twisting alleys. And as we approach, we hear the gunshots. It's a firefight between soldiers for the Palestinian Authority, or PA, which governs much of the West Bank, and another faction of Palestinians inside the Jenin camp. Soon, we hear someone has been killed and taken to the hospital. We enter a waiting room already full of tear-streaked family members and masked PA soldiers, assault rifles strapped to their chests. One woman is overcome with grief. She tells us the PA fatally shot her husband after he went up to the roof of their home and her son later died. She begins shouting at the PA soldiers. "May you suffer like we are suffering," she says. Then her mother joins in. She yells she would have expected this from the Jews, meaning Israel, but not from fellow Arabs. The Jenin camp houses Palestinian refugees, including those expelled from their homes by Israeli forces. In 2002, the Israeli army briefly occupied the camp after deadly fighting, and it last raided it this past September. And the camp has remained a stronghold for resistance against Israel. But this time, it is Palestinian forces attacking the camp. It started this past December. Iyad Issa, an intelligence officer with the PA, explains. He says the PA is trying to root out what he calls outlaws hiding inside the Jenin camp. He accused them of trying to undermine the PA by showing it cannot control Jenin City and giving Israel's military a pretext to come in. Radi Jarai is a former PA minister. He adds the PA also has ambitions of governing Gaza if there is a ceasefire with Israel. But
in order to give you a role in Gaza, you have to settle problems here in the West Bank.
So the PA is trying to prove themselves by first eliminating resistance in the Jenin camp. But in trying to stamp them out, the PA risks losing popular support. Gunfire punctuates an imam singing at Friday prayers. I'm now at the mosque abutting the Jenin camp with Mohammed Abahara. He's a radiologist at the hospital on the camp's periphery.
You hear this every day?
I hear this every day from 4 years.
Camp residents say the fighting has destroyed the camp's power and water lines. And yet, like most, Abahara staunchly supports the Jenin fighters, not the PA.
The fighter is our defense against the Israeli army, because our government cannot protect us.
The fighters are mostly young men who have fought and sometimes died fighting Israeli security forces. Now they are refusing to put down their arms against the PA, which Jenin resident Mustafa Jarar accuses of despotism. He says a few weeks ago, PA soldiers detained him because he was walking without his ID, then beat him.
Yeah.
You're the son of the mayor.
Yeah, I actually never expected it to happen.
The deaths resulting from this fight with the PA are dividing Palestinians at a time when many feel unity is needed. Retired hospital administrator Suleiman Turkman has been trying to mediate a truce.
Two groups, they are two brothers.
meaning the PA and Jenin camp fighters are on the same side, he says, fighting their common enemy, Israel.
This is a problem for the Palestinian people. They have to find a solution, not only in Jenin. It's from the whole West Bank, from inside and outside. We have to find a solution for that. Otherwise, we lose everything.
He fears this Palestinian-on-Palestinian violence could spread to other refugee camps, ultimately giving Israel the upper hand in deciding not just a ceasefire in Gaza, but also the future of Palestinians in the West Bank. Emily Fang, NPR News, Jenin.
Our guts are home to trillions of microbes that have a profound influence on our overall health. Now, a new study finds that whether you're vegan, vegetarian, or an omnivore, the key to a healthy gut microbiome is the same. NPR's Maria Godoy explains.
The bacteria in our gut are tiny, but their impact is mighty. Gut microbes break down food that your body can't digest. And in turn, they produce chemical messengers that influence everything from your blood sugar levels to your immune system. Some of these messengers can boost health, others can hinder it. It all depends on what you feed your microbes.
The microbiome modulates the effect of diet on our health. This basically decides our health status.
That's Nicola Sagatta. He's a researcher at the University of Trento in Italy who uses genomic sequencing to study the microbiome. He and an international team of colleagues wanted to know how different diet patterns shape the kind of microbes that dominate the gut. So they analyzed stool samples from more than 21,000 people in three countries, the US, the UK, and Italy, who followed different diets.
We looked at these three dietary patterns, vegan, vegetarians, and omnivores.
And what they found is the more plant-based foods people ate, the more gut bacteria they had that are linked with better health, such as less inflammation and a stronger immune system. The good news for meat eaters is that when it comes to good bacteria, their microbiomes looked a lot like those of vegans and vegetarians, so long as they ate lots of plants. Hannah Holscher is a microbiome researcher at the University of Illinois who was not involved in the study.
So what the researchers are essentially saying is that eating an array of plant-based foods is more important than strictly adhering to a vegan or vegetarian diet pattern.
In other words, it's the overall quality of the diet that counts. The study is one of the largest of its kind. Holscher, who is also a dietitian, says it adds to existing evidence that supports advice nutritionists love to give. For better health, eat the rainbow.
Meaning lots of different types of colorful plant foods. Think tomatoes, butternut squash, pineapple, avocado, broccoli and kale, blueberries and eggplant. And really don't forget about those whole grains, nuts, seeds and legumes.
She says a simple goal is to eat five different plant-based foods every day. Think about making bean soups with lots of vegetables or mixing up some pears or berries in your salad.
Make some overnight oats before you go to bed. When you're leaving for work in the morning, you're looking around, what can you toss into your bag? An apple, an orange, a banana.
She says, give yourself as many opportunities as possible to snack on more plants every day. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
A new history book explores how the Kennedy administration cracked down on the mafia.
When JFK got elected, he appointed Bobby as his attorney general, and Bobby used all of the resources at his disposal to now destroy the mafia in America, which he considered the enemy within.
We'll speak with the author of Borgata, Clash of Titans. We'll also have coverage of the state funeral of Jimmy Carter tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Elsa Chang. More than 1,000 homes, businesses, and other buildings have burned across LA County.
Coming up, we'll look at how 7 landmarks in Los Angeles have been affected by the destructive fires.
Fires have a tendency to be much more ferocious than they ever have been.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Firefighters are working into the night here in the Los Angeles area as several separate wildfires remain out of control with zero containment, the latest forcing evacuations in the Hollywood Hills this evening. More than 300,000 customers are without power, with at least 5 deaths reported so far. Southern California hasn't seen any significant rain since last spring, and NPR's Jason DeRose describes how weather conditions continue to keep residents on edge in the Santa Monica area.
Winds are gusting pretty heavily. There are a lot of downed trees, downed branches in the area, and you can see ash and embers floating through the air. There's a lot of concern that the fire could jump the Santa Monica Canyon because of those winds and move into a really densely populated area on the northern end of this city of about 100,000 people.
That's NPR's Jason DeRose. The air quality for millions of Angelenos has been impacted by these wildfires. NPR's Alejandro Barunda explains why wildfire smoke is dangerous to our health and how to protect yourself.
Scientists think wildfire smoke is worse for people's health than regular air pollution. That's partly because of the high burn temperatures. But the fires in Los Angeles right now are also burning through lots of man-made materials. Lisa Miller is a wildfire smoke expert at the University of California, Davis.
The man-made materials, so things in cars, things in homes, think of all the synthetic fibers that are present in just in your living room, right? All of those things can be particularly toxic.
Doctors and scientists suggest getting away from the smoke if at all possible. Otherwise, stay indoors with the windows shut. Run air filters if you can, and wear an N95 mask if you have to go outside.
This is NPR. The alleged 9/11 mastermind is scheduled to plead guilty Friday in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in a plea deal that takes the death penalty off the table. NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer has more.
The DOJ interceding in this case is the latest twist in an unusual legal saga. It started last summer when plea deals were reached with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his co-defendants, who have still not gone to trial more than 2 decades after the 9/11 attacks. But Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin quickly reversed those deals. He said they caught him off guard and the case should continue toward trial. He's now been overruled by 2 military courts that say the guilty pleas can go forward. So the Justice Department has stepped in. A federal court will now decide whether to stop Mohammed from pleading guilty or at least cancel Friday's hearing while it considers whether to halt the plea. Sasha Pfeiffer, NPR News.
New federal warning labels designed to help consumers pick devices that are less vulnerable to hacking should be available sometime this year. Smart devices like fitness trackers and baby monitors, as well as internet-connected appliances, will carry the new labels that certify they meet federal safety standards. The program is voluntary and will begin once manufacturers submit their various devices for approval. I'm Dwayne Brown. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from C3 AI. C3 Generative AI works to enable rapid access to hallucination-free insights from enterprise systems using any LLM, helping turn the invisible into the obvious. This is Enterprise AI. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The massive fires driven by blasting winds here in Los Angeles have already caused thousands of evacuations of businesses and homes. The city's cultural landscape is also under threat. Here to provide an update on that front is NPR's Chloe Veltman. Hi, Chloe.
Hi there, Elsa.
Hi. Okay, so can you just give us the big picture first? Because Los Angeles, it's home to so many museums, so many important cultural sites and landmarks. What is gone now, or what is still in danger at the moment?
Well, as you well know, Elsa, Los Angeles is huge, and most of the places listeners might be familiar with the Hollywood Walk of Fame, for example, those are quite far from the fires. Mm-hmm. But there's a beloved place, Will Rogers State Historic Park, that has the Actors Ranch House, a lot of Western memorabilia. It's on the U.S. National Register of Historic Places. That's right in the Palisades fire zone, and the fire has burned the ranch house basically to the ground. And it has impacted the surrounding property, and officials are out there assessing the full extent of the damage.
I mean, when I heard that news, I was devastated because I always peek through the windows when I hike around that area, imagining what it would have been like to live there.
That's right. It's just awful news. The fire also destroyed parts of Topanga State Park, including the historic Topanga Ranch Motel, which was once owned by William Randolph Hearst. And meanwhile, the Getty Villa has had a close call. It's an estate with important Greek and Roman sculpture and other artifacts. It's also located in the Palisades fire zone. And trees and brush were burning there yesterday.
Are all the staff members safe at the moment? And what about the buildings and the art there?
So far, staff, buildings, and collections at the villa are safe. I spoke with Michael Rogers. He's the Getty's director of facilities.
We have a strong culture of safety within the institution. We think about emergencies and preparedness constantly.
What has the Getty been doing specifically to keep fires at bay?
Rogers says as soon as they saw the warnings, they made sure they were properly staffed and the emergency services had clear places to do their work on site. And throughout the year, they've been preparing and planning for these kinds of emergencies. For example, cutting back vegetation, doing fuel reduction around the site and its borders.
So should a fire come on like it did, it doesn't have as much energy in it to effectively damage your buildings and your surroundings.
Wow, that's very reassuring. It sounds like the Getty, you know, it's well equipped to handle potentially devastating emergencies like this. But how true is that across the board in Los Angeles?
Well, I think it's largely true. I spoke with Jennifer Caballero. She's the executive director of the California Association of Museums. And she says, you know, fires are getting worse because of human-caused climate change. And so museums, not just in LA, but also across the state, are preparing.
A lot of us in the museum world have seen these terrible situations and taken time and resources to really shore up the structures and collections and their irreplaceable artifacts and buildings.
It's notable that the Getty Center, the sister museum to the Getty Villa, was so well prepared in 2019 when a big wildfire swept through that it escaped unscathed. But smaller cultural institutions that don't necessarily have the resources of, say, a Getty are more prone to disaster.
Exactly. So are there any other cultural landmarks that have been impacted by these fires?
Yep. Other museums closed. Norton Simon Museum, Pasadena, that's near the Eaton Fire, has a very important art collection. And some of the works are outdoors, like sculptures by Rodin. So that's worrying. There's lots of other culturally significant places in LA. The stretch of Sunset Boulevard, the West Hollywood Strip, known for its hopping nightlife and restaurant scene, that's closed. The Griffith Observatory, LA Zoo, and the Rose Bowl Stadium, which isn't considered high risk, but it's being used as a large animal evacuation center right now, according to the LA Sheriff's Department.
That is NPR's Chloe Veltman. Thank you so much, Chloe.
You're welcome, Elsa.
A legal drama is playing out this week in a 9/11 terrorism case at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. It involves Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, who is trying to block the alleged mastermind of the September 11th attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, from pleading guilty this Friday. NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer covers Guantanamo. Hi.
Hi, Ari.
Tell us the backstory here.
So last summer, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and three other men agreed to plead guilty in exchange for life in prison or up to life in prison. They would admit guilt in the deaths of nearly 3,000 people on September 11th, and then the 9/11 case would finally be almost wrapped up more than 20 years after those attacks. But Secretary Austin reversed those deals 48 hours later. He says he was caught off guard, which is wild because this is a huge case with international implications. But that started a legal fight where Austin has been told by two military courts emphatically that he cannot retroactively cancel a plea deal. But he's kept pushing and pushing, and last night he involved the Justice Department.
Austin leads the Defense Department, so how did the Justice Department get involved?
It's a legal process in which they ask them to intercede and do two things. First, Justice has asked a federal appeals court to block the guilty pleas. Second, it's asked the court to at least delay Friday's plea hearing if the court wants more time to think about whether to halt the pleas.
How typical is that kind of intervention, the Justice Department getting involved in a military court?
Defense attorneys for Guantanamo prisoners have often asked a federal court to intercede, although they usually lose. But a Georgetown University law professor who follows Guantanamo told me this situation, where the prosecution, the government side, has already lost twice and now wants a federal court to order a military court to block the guilty pleas, is rare. So this is Steve Vladek.
To call it unusual is a vast understatement. I mean, we've had the military commissions in some way, shape, or form now for over 20 years, and we haven't had a case like this before.
And Ari, for now, Mohammed is still scheduled to plead guilty this Friday and the other defendants next week.
Well, how is the federal court expected to rule? Is it likely to stop the guilty plea or let it go forward?
The two previous military rulings against Austin say he is too late. The plea deals were made. It's done. The federal appeals court might agree with that. But several lawyers told me the court might delay Friday's hearing to have more time to deliberate, even if the court ultimately rules against Austin and lets the 9/11 plea deals go through. Here's a former military commission's attorney named Ian Moss, who now works in private practice.
At the end of the day, I think the pleas are likely to be reinstated. It's just, do we have to wait another however many years?
Years.
Maybe. I mean, who knows?
Ari, this gets at how slow and dysfunctional the Guantanamo legal process has been. It is widely considered hopelessly gridlocked. Austin's own prosecutors have said plea deals are the best resolution. But now, just as it looks like there's a light at the end of the tunnel and President Biden might get closer to his goal of closing Guantanamo, we could instead be in for more endless litigation. Here's another exchange I had with Ian Moss.
It does seem like what's happening now is just kind of the pinnacle of the mess of Guantanamo.
Yes, 100, yes, exactly. That's exactly what it is. Like, of course, this would be how Gitmo plays out in the final weeks of the administration. There's been gnarly politics that surround everything related to Guantanamo.
Okay, Sasha, so once a federal court issues a ruling on whether Mohammed will be allowed to plead guilty Friday, then what?
Well, one side will certainly be unhappy with the outcome, so the expectation is that this case will eventually likely end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. That would be the next step after a federal appeals court ruling, and that process could take a very long time.
And just briefly, how are 9/11 family members reacting to all this?
Universal feelings, frustration, exhaustion, some angry that plea deals might happen and there's no trial. Others just want it to end, so they're fine with prison sentences.
NPR Sasha Pfeiffer, thank you.
Thanks, Ari.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Time now for My Unsung Hero, our series from the team at the Hidden Brain podcast. My Unsung Hero tells the stories of people whose kindness left a lasting impression on someone else. And today's story comes from Charlie Essers. One spring evening in 2023, Charlie was waiting for his wife, Ilana, to bike home from work, and he had just finished making dinner when he got a notification from Ilana's smartwatch that she had fallen.
So I jumped in the car and raced over to where she was about a mile from home to find her lying in the middle of the road with her bicycle off to the side and four cars blocking the street from all directions. And she was surrounded by these four women, four strangers who had stopped and were blocking traffic and holding her in the middle of the road. It was a pretty bad accident, and emergency crews came and the women stepped aside. She was in a lot of pain and it required emergency surgery. And in the chaos of all that, I never got the name of those four beautiful, angelic women who protected the love of my life lying there in the middle of that dirty road. And I never saw them again. And I am so grateful to them. If I could see them, I would give them all a giant hug and let them know what they mean to our family. It could have gone so different with my wife just lying unprotected in the road. But instead, these four ladies protected her. A couple of months later, I had a yard sign made that said thank you to them and put it at the end of that street, hoping that at least one of them would see it and know how much they meant to us. We go by that intersection a couple of times a week, and their love and generosity and selflessness makes me smile every single time.
Charlie Essers of Lancaster, California. You can find more stories of unsung heroes at hiddenbrain.org.
Protecting endangered ecosystems is usually the work of governments, but with a mechanism called a biodiversity credit, the private sector might be able to contribute. The team at Planet Money bought one and went to the mountains of South America to see if it could help save animals like the spectacled bear, made famous in children's books.
Are you ready to own our own little piece of the cloud forest?
I'm ready to save Paddington.
Hear that story tomorrow on All Things Considered. If you're not by the radio, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR or your station by name.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Most weeks on our Wildcard podcast, host Rachel Martin asks a famous guest to draw a card from the Wildcard deck and answer a big question about their life. Well, recently, Rachel tried something different. She went to Washington Square Park in New York City and got a random selection of people to play the game. You know the drill. Rachel starts by asking them to pick a card, one, two, or three.
Two. Yeah.
What's a place you consider sacred?
A place I consider sacred is, it doesn't necessarily exist for me anymore because my parents did have to give away my car, but it would be the car that I learned to drive in.
You tell what went down in the car to make it sacred.
Nothing out of the ordinary, just a lot of really happy memories. I think driving became an outlet for me, especially because I learned to drive during COVID. So that was kind of a time for a lot of people my age. We were bottled up in the house. We couldn't really leave. So when I was stressed about college apps, when I was stressed about school, life, whatever it might be, I would go in my car and I would just go on drives, long drives. Sometimes it was 2 a.m. drives, but it was what I needed. And it became a place where I just felt at home. I felt myself, and whenever my friends needed to go places or just vent, I was the first person to kind of drive over in my car, pick him up, and that became our spot for just sort of, you know, being teenagers and hanging out. Yeah. So I miss my car a lot, but
definitely be sacred.
Yeah.
Three new cards. Mm-hmm. One, two, or three?
Two.
Okay. What's something you think of very differently than you did 10 years ago?
Oh, 10 years ago. So my son is now 22 years old, and 10 years ago he was still 12 years old, and at that time, I wanted to make him a successful person in the world of economy, or like
financially. I wanted him to be successful,
like a good businessman, or like socially.
Yeah.
So money and fame and connection, such kind of things.
Yeah.
I prioritized when I raised him.
Yeah.
Like, for example, my son went to a very good private school from elementary school, so he's got a good connection with important friends, like their
rich and famous friends. With rich and famous parents.
But so he is now a kind of person who lives in that kind of world, but he himself is happy. I'm not sure if it is good for him now at the moment. Like, maybe he wants to be an artist, or I'm not sure. And he's not sure, I think, because I raised him in the limited world.
And now you're thinking,
so, yeah,
that's, you want his world to be bigger.
So, yeah, that's the difference.
Cards, one, two, or three?
I'll do three.
Three?
Yes.
Is there anything in your life that feels like praying?
Feels like praying?
Yeah.
I think that when I'm being immersed in nature, that feels like praying to me, especially being in the ocean. So I'm from Hawaii. I was born and raised in Hawaii. I'm Native Hawaiian. I grew up a few minutes from the beach. Did water sports my entire life, canoe paddling, kayaking, swimming, surfing. So I'm very in touch with the ocean. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I think when I'm in the ocean, that feels like I'm called to like a higher self. And you look down, it's deep blue. You can barely see land out. Yeah. It's really humbling. Yeah. And
humbling's a good word.
Yeah, it's humbling.
That's a word that helps define what praying can be.
And I, exactly. And I think it invokes a sense of awe and deep gratitude when you realize that maybe the thing that I'm worrying about is not, it's not as deep as I'm making it out to be. It's, it really trivializes these small things that it do seem worrying in the moment. And here, obviously, the Hudson River is very different, but I live right by the Hudson. I'm on West 54th and 11th, so I, when I need that moment of kind of stepping out of myself and from my worries, I'm like, body of water, get me there. Just, it's a centering.
Somehow that water is still connected,
yes,
to the waters,
exactly,
off of Oahu.
Exactly. It, and that's the thing that, as a Native Hawaiian who's grown up with that cultural upbringing, a lot of our ancestral wisdom shares that oceans don't separate us, they actually connect us. So
where's your mom?
It's my mom.
Good job, mom.
That was NPR's Rachel Martin speaking with New Yorkers Saina Mara, Sachiko Shiraishi, and Teyana Gonzalez. And you can hear more of those conversations on the Wildcard podcast.
Okay, before we go, a quick update on the major story we've been following today. There are at least three major fires and several smaller fires in the greater Los Angeles area. That's according to the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection.
Dry, gusty conditions are fueling the flames. At least two people have been killed and many more injured, including firefighters. Tens of thousands of people have been ordered to evacuate, and across the region, people are describing devastating scenes.
Ted Soke is an LA-based freelance photographer who's been covering fires for 40 years. He told the nonprofit news outlet Cal Matters that he's never seen anything like this week's fires.
And I'm watching the church, Altadena Baptist Church, burn to the ground. There's no fire protection, and nobody could stop it. There's nobody out here to stop it. And it's eerily quiet, except it's punctuated by loud booms, maybe propane tanks or transformers, and crackling of the fire, and then sometimes a complete howl of the wind. You know, people say it's surreal, and this is the proper time to use that term. I mean, it is a surreal experience.
The wildfires have left more than 400,000 homes and businesses without power. More than 1,000 structures have been destroyed.
Stay with NPR for the latest on the wildfires and how local officials are responding.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Cunard, with round trips from Miami to the Caribbean on Cunard's Queen Elizabeth. Guests can dine on flavors of the Caribbean and explore local life on shore in Antigua, Barbados, St. Lucia, and beyond. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Stay inside the deep door and not be brown-skinned girls. Stay home and